Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, we've got John McGraw. John is the man behind Bitcoin Medellin Conference. It is the first conference down in Medellin, Colombia. It's in January. You're going to want to check this out. Sounds like they are going to have a very cool, very intimate event where you're going to get to meet and engage with a lot of these speakers. They have a great lineup. So really excited to see how this goes for him. And I hope you'll have the opportunity to make it and that you enjoy this show. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got John with me today. John, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really appreciate you having me on. Certainly excited about some of the stuff you guys are doing and look forward to chatting with you this morning.
Yeah, I think you guys are doing some important stuff. I mean, global adoption is I think going to be key. It's going to really spread some of the, you know, jurisdictional risk that I think a lot of people see with Bitcoin. What sort of legislation is going to come about? And it seems like South America, maybe generally, is prime for Bitcoin adoption. So let's start with, so you sort of split your time, it sounds like, between the United States and in Colombia. How did you end up finding Colombia? What led you there? And we'll, of course, talk about the conference and the event that you're putting on here in just a bit.
Yeah, sure. Well, just in full transparency, I do spend most of my time here in Jacksonville, Florida. But love Medellin and, have traveled there numerous times now and have a trip there in 2 weeks to try to get the stuff further coordinated, make sure we're ready to go for January. So, the way I kind of found it just happened to be I've been running events for 25 years and my kind of calendar year usually ends at the end of July. And so every August, my wife and I try to go somewhere where we haven't been and just see a new place and experience a different culture. And a couple of years back, probably 4 years ago now, we decided like, hey, Colombia might be a little more adventurous than, sitting on the beach in Cancun or, Jamaica or somewhere. So we went to Medellin for a couple of days, then went over to Cartagena for a couple of days. And we just fell in love with Colombia. And now we've been back a couple of times. And so, as event planners, when we were thinking about like, hey, we want to be more involved in the Bitcoin space, how can we kind of facilitate that? How can we kind of contribute in some way? We thought like, well, there's so much Bitcoin kind of education and events going on already. Like we live in Florida. There's a ton of stuff down here. And there's just a bunch of stuff in the United States in general. We just came back from Los Angeles. We were at Fred Krueger's Bitcoin First event. We were at Swan's Bitcoin Day. And so, we just thought there's a lot going on here in the U.S. and where could we run an event that would really help, the local people, the local economy, spread global adoption. And so Colombia was really a place where we thought, one, there's like a ton of digital nomad people living there, a ton of tech entrepreneur, young startup people living there. It's extremely affordable. It's a beautiful modern city that I think, Americans may be familiar with on kind of a Narcos, Pablo Escobar type of thing. And they don't realize like how much it's changed and how awesome it is. And so I think some people are starting to kind of figure that out and their tourism is really picking up. And so we just felt like this is a perfect opportunity to bring something to a place that could really benefit from it. And, all the while, like us taking what we do for a living and our kind of expertise and, putting it to work in the Bitcoin space. So that's kind of how it came about.
Yeah, I've heard great things about the area. So I didn't realize that you were in event planning, that's been your career. What sort of event planning have you done historically?
Yeah, so about 25 years ago, I was working in corporate America for a pharmaceutical company, like basically selling drugs to doctors. And got out of that, got involved. I had been a basketball, like a student employee for UMass men's basketball. So I was there like during Final Fours and Marcus Camby time. And got into coaching like youth girls basketball, something I would have never imagined. And the group I was volunteering for, we needed money. And so we just threw an event to kind of raise money, like a tournament. And it went really well. And then it snowballed. And 25 years later, I have a company that does like 30 events per year. We do about $2 million a year in revenue. And so, you know, been doing this since 2000. And coached college basketball for 15 years along the way. And this was kind of like my side, you know, hustle for probably the first 7 or 8 years of my college coaching career. And then it turned into, blossomed into a totally full-time gig. So, you know, now we organize, you know, some of our major events are at convention centers. We're, you know, organizing, you know, events with, you know, 6,000-7,000 spectators and participants. And so this is kind of right up our alley to organize, you know, a big group event at a facility. So it's something we do pretty regularly. And, you know, this is our first endeavor in the Bitcoin space, but you know, we're pretty excited about it.
So cool. So most of the time is your company putting on an event, like doing the logistics, all of that management work for someone else's event? Is this your first event that you're actually running and not just managing, that I guess it's your event, so to speak?
Yeah, no, even the basketball events, they're 100% our events.
I mean, okay.
We're doing all the work and they're ours. Like, we're not doing the work for someone else. We're doing it for us, essentially.
Got it. Okay. So yeah. This isn't your first rodeo.
No, we do this pretty regularly, but, you know, again, this is the first one in the Bitcoin space. So it's definitely, you know, a lot different. I mean, we're having to like start from scratch, like our basketball event business. We have teams that play with us every single year. And so part of it is like, you know, just reaching out to them. This is what the schedule is going to be for 2025. And like, you know, was there anything that happened in 24 that we might need to, you know, shore up with you? But essentially, we kind of can count on a pretty good base of teams and people that, you know, that we know are going to rock with us. So, you know, this is a whole new thing where it's like, you know, going out on a limb, like, hey, is this going to even work or, you know, or not? So, I mean, we've kind of reached that point of no return. Like, we're doing this. It doesn't matter, you know, how good or bad it goes, where it's going to happen. Like, there won't be any Pacific Bitcoin refunds here. Like, this event is 100% going to go down. So
I love it. Well, we're going to talk more about the event in just a moment. I do want to hear, though, your Bitcoin origin story. So what brought you into Bitcoin to begin with?
Yeah, actually, I was the athletic director of a junior college here in Florida, and their head coach and the school tried to get rid of athletics altogether. So when my contract was up, of course, you know, as the AD, I fought them on getting rid of intercollegiate athletics. Obviously, you know, I mean, I'm a proponent of athletics, and they wanted to just pare it down to some intramuros. And, you know, I kind of said like, no way. And so when my contract was up, they didn't renew it. So I just happened to be at home. This was, you know, fall of 2016, and just kind of sitting around, you know, feeling a little sad that I didn't have a job and like a paycheck and a 401k. And, you know, the funny thing is like they were paying me probably an infinitely small amount of money for what a college AD should be making. And my event business was probably already making almost triple the money that I was getting paid from the school. And I was still sad. Like, I think like your mindset when you grow up in America is like paycheck, 401k, insurance, direct deposit, get the taxes taken out. Like, you're just programmed to like, I have to have a job, right? Like, I have to have this job that pays me and I get a paycheck. And it's, you know, at least I'm Gen X. So I think at least in my generation, I know we kind of thought like high school, college, get a job, get a paycheck, start working on your pension. And it just, you know, it doesn't always have to be like that. Like, it was so scary for me to lose this like $50,000 job when I was already making triple on my own. It just was like, you know, the event business was just like a risk though, right? Like, it could all fall apart at any time. So anyway, you know, I was just kind of depressed. I didn't have this job anymore. I didn't have a paycheck anymore. And was just sitting around like, I don't know, I want to say August maybe. And I saw a segment on a Silk Road documentary about a guy who was saying like, hey, I've done enough in life that I can't like take the risk of like going on Silk Road and buying stuff and then selling it. But I want to be able to like, I'm kind of integrated in the economy by like, I buy Bitcoin on a local peer-to-peer network and then just sell it on the streets of Brooklyn to people who are, you know, interested in buying non-KYC Bitcoin. And I don't know what they're doing. They might not be doing anything illegal. They might totally be doing, you know, what, like, totally legal stuff. Who knows? But I sell it to them at a premium and then, like, also charge, like, a transaction fee on top of that. And I'm making, like, $2,000 a month. And I'm like, holy cow, like, I could probably do this, you know, as a side hustle until, like, because, you know, the events don't make money until, like, the event actually happens. So, you know, so, like, my events weren't until March. There was nothing until then. So this was August. So I'm like, well, I have no cash flow coming in since I don't have a job. So let me go be, like, a peer-to-peer salesman for Bitcoin. So right away, I ran out and bought some inventory. So that was, you know, it was a good time in August of 2016 to go buy a bunch of inventory. And thankfully for me, like, it did not sell very well. I ended up having to keep a lot of the inventory I bought, which worked out really well in the long run. So that's kind of how I got involved. And then over time, like anyone, I think you just go down the rabbit hole and you start to figure out, like, hey, why is the government printing so much money? And then, you know, for me being in 2016, by the time we got to 2020 and COVID, I was already like, oh, this is, you know, and I, excuse me, I don't know what the policy is here, but I was already like, this is a bunch of bullshit. I mean, like, you got to be kidding me, like, stay in your house, send everyone a bunch of checks. I mean, I have three kids. So, like, the checks rolled in for me. And literally the very first day I got a check, I told my wife, like, this is such bullshit. I'm like, I'm not going to turn down their free money because they're going to give it to everyone else. But, like, why are they doing this? Like, this is, like, the worst thing they could possibly do is dole out this free money left and right. And so, you know, and then, you know, of course, then I was getting hit up like, oh, you run a company that's been affected. You should take a PPP loan. And the just like the amount of people, like the amount of ways that the government tried to give you free money was really unbelievable. It was like, you just take whatever free money you wanted at that time. So, you know, the whole Bitcoin ethos was really easy, you know, for me to kind of, it was actually not super easy in the beginning, but, you know, of course I did reading and educated myself. And then eventually, like, the world does stuff that makes it really easy to see, like, okay, well, this makes a lot of sense why this, you know, this is really important. And this is, you know, the future of money. So, you know, I'm just really fortunate and blessed to have, you know, been around long enough. I mean, like anyone, I wish I was around in 2013 or 2011, but, you know, I mean, it's good to get Bitcoin at the price you deserve, I guess. So it was good for me.
So would it be fair to say in 2016, when you first got into it, you're looking at selling peer-to-peer, that you didn't fully understand or appreciate the use case of Bitcoin? It was more of a money-making opportunity. And then after the fact, you start learning more about it. You sort of went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, 100%. But at the same time, with the caveat that in a way I did understand the use case as a medium of exchange, right? I mean, like, I understood, like, hey, this is a censorship money that people can use for whatever they want. So, like, in a way I did understand some of it, like, instantaneously, like, this is a money that people can use, can't be censored. You know, that's kind of what my thought was the use case at that time. Obviously, I think I've kind of matured in my thinking of what the actual use case is at this point. And I understand, you know, like, scaling wise, like, where people aren't going to be buying, you know, people aren't going to be going on Silk Road and buying an eighth of weed anymore, or a cup of coffee, or, you know, whatever small minor purchases they're making. I mean, those have to, you know, kind of be done on layer twos at this point. But, you know, I certainly understand. I think I have a deeper understanding of really the use case that, you know, that Bitcoin is many things. And I think people had tried to just, you know, say, like, I'm a money maximalist, but I think Bitcoin's a lot of things in the sphere of money. So, so I think there's that. I mean, I think you learn over time how it matures in you as you kind of go down the rabbit hole into how you kind of view it. So, like, there are obviously store of value digital gold properties that it has that I did not understand at that point. And I, you know, and also, you know, so the supply issuance, I didn't understand that at that point. I don't even know if I realized there was only 21 million coins at that point. So, you know, those things become really important as time goes on.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, like, I came in thinking this is like an investment vehicle. I need to start learning about it because I'd heard about all this crypto buzz and, you know, maybe it's a get rich quick scheme or something, and was drawn in by number go up. And then, you know, over time, I just realized it was a, you know, for me, it became just a savings vehicle. Right. And then the more you think on it, the more you're like, oh, this is just, it's money. And it's the way money ought to work. It's the way a good money should work and operate. So yeah, it's always fun to hear just like the different angles people come at it with. And then they learn that it's, you know, it's always so much more than you originally thought.
Yeah. And so it's so much more. I mean, you know, if you told me when I was like a 15 or 16 year old kid, like, hey, guess what? One day, like, global macro finance will be your passion. I would have been like, that's absolutely ridiculous. Right. But like, how much do you love listening to, like, you know, James Lavish or Greg Foss or Larry Lepard talk about like macro now? You know, it's like, it's amazing. Like, those are the funnest people to listen to. And it's like, you know, who would have thought, like, you know, so many people would be interested in the fact that who would have thought that we'd all be so interested in that the U.S. can't control their spending. And, you know, we've, you know, winded our way into this massive debt spiral that they don't have a lot of options out of.
Yeah, you unplug from the matrix, there's no going back. And yeah. You named three of the greats there. So talk to me a bit about your conference in Medellin. I'm curious, you know, what do you anticipate people should expect? What are some of the themes, topics? Like, are we, you know, is it more macro centric, mining centric, technical? How would you distinguish it from other similar conferences and events?
Yeah, I think one of the great things about Medellin is going to be that it's going to be, I would say a couple things. One, it'll be, I think, a lot more intimate than a lot of these conferences, especially the ones that have been around and been established. Like, they're going to have thousands of people, most of them, and really getting to chat and kind of rub elbows with some of the, you know, main speakers we have, I think would be really difficult at most conferences. You know, I've been to a lot of them, and, you know, just having, you know, just being a normal pleb at a lot of these conferences is like, you don't really get to interact with the people that are the key speakers or the main people. And, you know, of course, you know, as human beings, like, we, you know, we listen to people and we see people talking about subjects, and we kind of consider them experts in the field. And if it's a field that we're interested in and passionate about, like, we want to interact with those people, right? Like, we want to get information from them more than just like what they spoke about. We might have things that are questions in our mind about something that we want clarified. And so, you know, you don't normally get to chat with, you know, Jeff Booth or, you know, Maya, who's running for president of Suriname, just, you know, at, you know, I'm sure at most of these conferences, that's not a high likelihood. But at ours, I think we're going to be, you know, it's a first year thing. It's not going to be massive amount of people. You're going to have these opportunities. So I think it's going to be a lot more intimate, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, like, a lot of the Bitcoin events I've been to have been pretty fun in terms of, like, there being some, you know, ancillary opportunities. So Luke Broyles is coming. One of the things he's going to do is he's organizing like a 3-day kind of like hiking, bouldering type of like outdoor experience, which he's also doing in El Salvador, which I think will be awesome in Colombia. There's a lot of opportunities to do those things. And it's a beautiful country. Medellin is kind of in the mountains. It's like in a valley. So it's a really great place to do some of that stuff. I've been hiking there and it's beautiful. And then the nightlife there is incredible. So I'm sure we're going to do a couple, like, you know, after conference kind of get togethers, official and unofficial. We have a great steak dinner lined up for the VIPs on Thursday night. So yeah, I think there's some things that, you know, and it gives you an opportunity to get out of the U.S., see some other parts of the world. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So
I love that. Yeah. And it gets harder. I mean, is, you know, hopefully the conference will grow for you over time. I mean, I know this is your first year, but it gets harder to have those sort of intimate settings with people that you probably have burning questions to ask. And for us, we do private webinars for our newsletter subscribers, and the questions, I mean, people just have so many questions they want to ask of our partner, you know, companies that we work with, of, you know, some of these, like, one of the gentlemen you talked about is someone we're going to have on next month. And I love that they'll have those in-person opportunities to get to shake hands and meet with some of these people. It's one of the most special things about the Bitcoin community.
Yeah, I think the space is really growing right now. So like when I was at Bitcoin First in LA the other day, like some of the loan products that coming out are getting more and more sophisticated to like borrow against your Bitcoin. So I know, like, I think that's like a pretty hot topic. It's going to be in this cycle. Like people don't want to sell their Bitcoin, right? Like I'm at the point, like I've been stacking and stacking and stacking since 2016. It's like, I don't ever want to sell any of this. Like I want to be able to retain all of it. So like, how can I do that in a really safe way without risking any of my Bitcoin, but still being able to leverage it for, you know, dollars? And I think that's, I think there's a lot of people really working on that. And I think there's a lot of innovation going on right now. So I think that these conferences are going to be really good. And I think to your point, people are going to have a lot of questions. I mean, like there's a, like when we were at Bitcoin First, I mean, it was done basically in a, like what was like a real life spaces. Like they put like three or four people in charge. And then the people that were interested, they like had couches set up, and it was a very unique format of a conference that I've been to. And there were so many questions. People had so many questions. It was unbelievable. So yeah, I think we'll be able to answer a lot of the people will have an opportunity to ask questions and get them answered at our event. Whereas, you know, like if you went to Bitcoin Nashville, like there was no asking Saylor any questions, right? I mean, yeah. He was on a huge stage in front of thousands of people. You couldn't raise your hand and ask him something.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. So, well, speaking of, you know, some of these folks that you're going to have, you looks like you've pulled together some incredible speakers. What was the process like bringing these people in, convincing them to make it down to Columbia for a new event?
Yeah. So, you know, funny, like I find sometimes in doing this event, like there are things that like, I'm totally unfamiliar with and don't know how to do, or like, just don't have a lot of experience dealing with. But one of the things that worked really good that was really relatable to the basketball space is like when we run these big, huge tournaments for basketball, they're for college coaches to come like scout and try to find players to recruit, or they already know a player and they're coming to like sit there on the baseline and make sure that the player, you know, sees that like a coach from Miami is there. So they're all decked out in Miami gear. And then other teams, if they know that there's going to be a lot of college coaches at your event, they like, you know, it's very easy to get other teams and you can charge more for them to play and so on and so forth. So one of the things that we know from that is like we have to go get some really good teams to play in our events in the beginning stages. And if that means we have to like comp their admission or like maybe even like, you know, help them in some way, like hire their coach as a consultant to take care of a couple thousand dollars for them to get them to come to our event. Like that means we're going to get college coaches. And then that means like we're going to be able to draw a lot of other like not quite as good teams or teams that aren't of that caliber that they are going to like easily draw college coaches on their own. So the parallel to that was I immediately was like, okay, to get good speakers, we have to get some really good people on board first. So the very first thing I did was I reached out to like five people that I like have absolute admiration for, Jeff Booth being one of them. And Jeff got back to me really quick and said, you know, hey, like I have a person that you need to talk to who's like my agent, and talk to them, but I'd love to do it. Talk to the agent. We got things kind of squared away right away. And Jeff was in. So then every other person I went to talk to, I was like, hey, I'm doing this conference. I already have the facility totally under contract. I have Jeff Booth under contract. You know, what do we need to do to get you involved in this event? And the dominoes kind of fell. Like we started off getting some speakers that probably weren't super big name people. But then after we got those, then it was like, okay, we have Jeff Booth, we have this person, this person, this person, you know, we'd love to have you involved. And, you know, and again, this is I'm a super transparent person. So like, I don't mind coming on here and saying this, like I'm funding this whole thing out of pocket. So I kind of reached a threshold of like, this is the amount of money I'm willing to spend and lose on this thing if we sell like, you know, like a minimal amount of tickets. So once I hit that point, now, even when I talk to speakers, I even tell them like, look, I'm doing this totally out of pocket. I have no more budget, but we'd love to have you come speak. And, you know, then we tell them some of the people that are speaking and they're like, yeah, we would love to. And so people are actually hitting me up pretty regularly to see if they can speak at this point. And, you know, we have like 30 speakers and we're only going to have one stage and it's 2 days. Like, I'm not sure how many more people we can take to speak, but you know, it's been, you know, it's gone really, that piece of it has gone extremely well. It was like, just get Jeff Booth on board. And then, you know, everything kind of starts lining up behind that. And he's really the kind of the inspiration for me even doing this conference. So it was really, you know, he was kind of the most important piece along the way. It's like, you know, because I think the biggest thing that resonates with me that he talks about is, you know, if we can't fix the old system from inside the old system, and it becomes really hard to like do things in the new system if we're just always operating in the old system. So it's like, part of me is like, okay, my events are kind of in this fiat world. And like, if I can now have an event in the Bitcoin world, then I'm doing more in the new system. And the more you can do in the new system, the better it is for the new system. At least, you know, that's been my takeaway. So.
Yeah. No, this is your proof of work, you know? And, I think Jeff, yeah, that's one of the things I really like about Jeff is he talks about he had this moment of he noted his own hypocrisy as he continued doing his legacy fiat work while talking about Bitcoin, promoting Bitcoin. And I think it's you know, it's sort of a catch-22 because I know people still need dollars to operate in the world in which we live or whatever their local currency is. But you know, hopefully that's a wake-up call for, you know, a lot of, you know, Bitcoin influencers, Bitcoin, you know, companies, Bitcoin tangential companies to accept Bitcoin and to promote this as if you truly believe it's a better form of money, are you accepting it? Are you using it? Are you still feeding sort of the fiat behemoth? And I think you're making the right call and putting your money where your mouth is. So kudos to you for that. There's you've got a speaker who I follow, listen to his podcast from time to time, George Gammon, and he the way it seems like he describes it is he more or less escaped the United States for Medellin. So I guess it's kind of easy for him to make it to an event like this.
I mean, that's the only reason I think we're getting him is he's there, you know? So he told me, yeah, like if I'm in town, I'll 100% do it. And he's, you know, he's like, okay, I think I'm going to be in town, so it shouldn't be an issue. I mean, cool. Like, literally he's just driving down off the mountain. Right.
So. Yeah. So what do you think though? So I've heard him talk about it and why he left the United States. And every time he comes back, he talks about like, he can more visibly see the deterioration in culture and society at large, because it's like, you know, you look in a mirror every day, you don't notice yourself getting older. He steps away from the United States and then comes back. So he has this like new perspective and he sees just a lot of the chaos going on that in the United States we begin to take for granted and don't realize is happening and unfolding.
Yeah.
What is it, do you think, that, you know, so he transplanted and, you know, went to Medellin, as his primary residence. What do you think it is about maybe Medellin specifically, Colombia more broadly, maybe South America generally? I don't know. You know, I know there are good places, there are bad places anywhere that, makes it hospitable, not only for its residents, but for people who are expats or looking for a second home or, a plan B or something like that.
Yeah. I just think it's the whole, like, I mean, you know, like George Gammon is like a real diehard Bitcoiner. He just hasn't fully come to those terms, his own terms with that yet. You know, because like, look, at the end of the day, like he's doing what every Bitcoiner is trying to do, right? Which is like, we exert our time and energy and expertise, in trade for, you know, most of us do it for US dollars. He's doing it for Colombian pesos right now, right? But like, you know, we're all exerting our time, energy, and expertise, you know, in this trade, and we don't want to lose the value that we're getting back. We don't want that to be eroded over time. And so part of living in Medellin, Colombia, South America in general is the you know, you're preserving you know, especially if he's earning in dollars, he's preserving, you know, his time, energy, and expertise, because things are just much more affordable there, right? And like, some of the people that I really enjoy listening to, I find it very interesting when they talk about like, essentially, like the higher the dollar goes versus a currency, the more like eventually less stable the US dollar will be, because all these other currencies will collapse into the dollar and then the dollar eventually blow up, like pop off, like the top will pop off the dollar because it'll essentially get so strong. I think George and the other people who have gone down there because they realize, you know, and to be fair, I mean, I don't think I would still be living in America if it wasn't for my children, you know? So like we've lived here because this is their routine, and like to take them out of it right now would kind of be like a shock to the system maybe. But for me, having like traveled and spent a lot of time in these places, it would not be hard for me to go there. And I think you'd be preserving, some of the money you've earned over your career, because it's been, you know, essentially a lot of it's been saved in dollars. And then, you know, how much value has that retained? We know, you know, it's pretty bad. I just heard Peter St. Ange speak out in LA, and, you know, I think he used a fact that like 49%, the value of a US dollar has lost 49% in the last 10 years. I mean, that's incredible. That's one decade. We've lost half the value of our money. And really, I don't even think about it as your money. It's like your time, energy, and expertise that you've lost half of. You've given it out and you've gotten something back for it. And now that something is half, which that's crap. So I think these guys are going down there because I think they can preserve their value a little bit better down there because things are a little more affordable. But, you know, I think George is like a true Bitcoiner and he just hasn't come to terms with it. So,
yeah, my sense of George is I think he's a bit of a contrarian, likes to play devil's advocate, which I think is really healthy. I think it's good to have people who are not antagonistic to Bitcoin like him, who have adopted it at least on some level. But yeah, make you think, and maybe don't drink the Kool-Aid on everything. I think he'll come around to a lot of this stuff because he's taking proactive steps that many Bitcoiners should take or would like to take or will in the future. But I think he's a good voice, and it at least makes you think. You know, I was thinking about, so we have a Plan B residency program in Panama that we offer at the Bitcoin Way. And our team just got back from Panama, had, I think, 20 or 30 people down there that we were onboarding into a residency program. And I mean, one of the families was planning on moving back, like going back the next week and starting their life, you know, in Panama.
Wow.
And I think it's these, it's like when you get out of that bubble and you experience some of these other options and you realize there are other options for the first time and there are good places and cost of living is better, it becomes much more palatable for people. And I'm hopeful for you that you get some, you know, Americans, some Europeans, some folks who might be looking for a Plan B or don't realize that they're hopeful for a Plan B, to get to this conference and maybe find a new home or at least a place to split their time or to have optionality when, if things get as bad as they potentially could from a censorship, free speech, cost of living perspective, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, I'm an American and, you know, I want to see, you know, America do well, and I want to see us, you know, kind of recover. And I hope and I think that we will, you know, but right now we've been headed down a bad path here financially, and I don't think they have a lot of ways out of it, and it could get worse, but hopefully eventually it gets better, because I know, you know, like, this is a great country. I mean, we've been a dominating country for a long time and one of the top countries for its citizens for a long time. And it's just sad to kind of see it go down this dark road, because it's like the easier path, right? The easier path is let's make it worse, just like let's make it worse by a little bit, because then nobody has to feel any pain here, or they do, but like they don't really know where it's coming from. And so it's like easier to just make things worse, you know, like let's put price controls on goods and services. Let's, you know, give everyone 25,000 home buyer credit. Like, let's just keep printing the money, you know, and people will think it's like, I don't know who I heard talk about it, but like, it's like, if you give the bottom people like some handouts, like they're going to keep voting for more pain, basically, right? They keep voting for more handouts, and the more they get, you know, the worse, the worse their situation keeps getting, but they don't realize it. They think they're getting something. In fact, they're just getting, you know, making their own situation worse. So hopefully we can get out of, like, hopefully we can take some painful measures, because they're going to be painful, and then get things back on track at some point. But, you know, so I just want to say that as an American, I don't want to think I don't want to be on here saying like, flee America, I grew up here and I want to see this place, do good. So
same here. I think it's just becoming more apparent to more people that optionality is a very useful tool. No. And the world's unpredictable, and it's I think many people would acknowledge, whether they can put their finger on why, they would acknowledge it's trending in the wrong direction in a lot of places and in a lot of ways. It seems like in South America, though, and we've talked a little bit about this, but I'd be curious to hear your opinion on one thing. It seems like you've got, the election of Javier Milei in Argentina. You've got Maya running as a Bitcoin president in Suriname. Expats moving to Central and South America. It seems like South America is primed for Bitcoin adoption on a broader scale. Besides sort of the obvious economic factors that may play into that, like, currency debasement, economic collapse in certain places, do you think there's like a, have you sensed like a cultural sort of variable that might be at play here? Like, is there something about South American culture, or maybe culture in pockets of South America, that make it more amiable to Bitcoin?
That's a great question. I don't know if I can like generally answer that, but I would say, I think part of the culture there has been to have leaders who have really done some unscrupulous things financially over the years throughout Central America and South America. So I think a lot of those countries kind of are primed, like you're saying. To me, a lot of it is stemming from like, they've already suffered a lot of the pain associated with like financial collapse and, financial debasement. So like they've already been through like suffering max pain. So they're kind of coming out on the other end of it saying like, hey, now we had like, it's a lot easier for them, having been through a lot of financial pain, to be open to accepting a new solution that has some great properties that seems to work. So I to me, that's really the main point of why it's much more, why they're much more primed to kind of do it. Here, I think you have people feeling pain, but they just have never felt it before, and it hasn't like really, the heat hasn't really turned up that high on them yet. So like they haven't come out the other end like looking for a solution, or like seeing that there might be a solution with Bitcoin. So I to me, that's the culture that's making it feel that way, that it's primed to have greater adoption.
Yeah, that makes sense. So as you have gone about promoting this event, is it apparent to you that interest in Bitcoin is growing? Like, are you seeing, as you travel there, are you seeing more retailers adopting Bitcoin? Are you seeing more meetups? Are there other telltale signs that adoption is sort of taking place in these areas of the world?
I think there definitely is. I mean, in terms of retail, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not really sure that we've gotten there yet to where retail is accepting Bitcoin. And really, I don't know if that's, while that would probably be great for adoption, I don't know that that's really the path that Bitcoin's going to take around the world, is having lots of retail places just accept base layer Bitcoin. Now, I can see, retailers accepting, Lightning, or like, like Fold has a great credit card now, right? Where you're like living on a Bitcoin standard and you have a, like a Visa, and it exchanges that. So the merchant gets dollars and you, keep all your savings in Bitcoin, which is incredible. So to me personally, I kind of see merchants and retail kind of accepting Bitcoin that way, at least for now, and then maybe progressing to, you know, accepting it a little, like maybe it goes Bitcoin to Bitcoin on layer two. But no, I just think the awareness is what I definitely can see around the world when I travel. Like, there's a lot more people who know what's going on with Bitcoin. It's that part is growing, like the education part and people's knowledge of what it is. And, you know, even just awareness of Bitcoin is growing tremendously. I've seen, and I've been in Kenya this past year. I've been in Colombia this past year. And then, you know, throughout the U.S. at different things. So I'm definitely seeing it. It's palpable that the buzz that, you know, we're kind of at the beginning of the next cycle is pretty apparent.
Yeah, I heard George Gammon, I think, actually, just in the last few months, he talked about sort of an adventure he went on, I think, in Argentina. And he basically was trying to make do with Bitcoin only. He had gold as an option, and then I think dollars. And,
yeah.
And so his takeaway, and I think maybe this is where I think George misses sometimes, is his takeaway was I basically couldn't get rid of my Bitcoin. Like, people weren't accepting it. I couldn't get rid of it anywhere. And at least it seemed like to him that was a sign that, you know, Bitcoin adoption isn't growing, or it's not going to be used as a medium of exchange in any near future. And for me, I think I'm with you on this. Like, I think there's a ways to go on. We need a pretty broad adoption. I have no idea what global percentage it is, but we need pretty broad adoption of this thing as a store of value, as something that people find value in, because there's not intrinsic value. And so they have to assign value to this thing called Bitcoin for its decentralized nature, its, you know, scarcity, all of censorship resistance, all these properties that we talk about a lot. And only once we reach some level of scale on that front, will I think more and more businesses be accepting it as a medium of exchange? Will I think volatility reduce, you know, to a point where you can use it as a unit of account? But we could be a ways away from that. And that is not to in any way disparage or in any way criticize the people who are building this as a medium of exchange today and creating some amazing solutions, Lightning. All of these things I think are awesome and need to start happening, because it isn't going to happen overnight.
Yeah.
Just because we reach 40% global adoption as a store of value. But I think that stuff's just going to take a lot more time. And, in fairness, there are a lot of people in the world who, when they receive money in whatever form they receive it or prefer it, they're using that money right away. Right. I mean, savings isn't even on the table as an option. And so as long as Bitcoin is somewhat exclusively a savings technology and somewhat exclusively a store of value, and they can't use it in any meaningful way, I think it's going to be a lot harder to, you know, to find retail merchants accepting it. But I think it'll take time. I think it's coming.
I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, if we don't have enough, if we have to have, like you said, there has to be greater acceptance of it as a store of value, so that most people are holding it. Cause right now most people who hold it go like, there's no way, like to me, like you could say, like, especially like, I mean, you look at someone like me, I mean, I'm a Bitcoin first Bitcoin buyer at $600 US, and now Bitcoin's 100x for me. And I'm still going like, I would never sell this for $65,000. I would never even consider trading it for goods or services unless they were goods or services within the new system, basically. And then I would maybe use them, use it, and then replace with US dollars, whatever I used it for. But like, for me, like, so it like, we haven't reached that point yet. Like, we have to get where most people are holding Bitcoin to savings. Then they can start spending on things that they truly value. And like, my wife and I talk about this all the time. On like a Bitcoin standard, the things that you value spending the Bitcoin on go up. Like, you need to have a higher quality product, right? You need to have, like, we've started recently, like, doing everything, like, no seed oils, doing everything natural. Like, we're buying eggs now that are $9 for a dozen versus going to, like, you know, Publix or the grocery store and paying like $4 or $3 a dozen, we're paying like 3x the price because we figured out that like the higher quality means a lot more. So like that's like, it's funny, like Bitcoiners, like we're not, like when we spend Bitcoin, we need it to be worth it. Right. You need to be, has to be something that you really feel strongly about to part you from your Bitcoin. So we have to get a lot more people saving a lot more in Bitcoin to get medium of exchange to be more optimal. And then, you know, once we get to that point, then qualities and services are really going to have to compete to be high quality and worth it for us to be able to be willing to part from that Bitcoin. People will spend frivolously a lot less when we're on a Bitcoin standard.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I feel this, and you don't even realize that until, like, I've told this story and make this joke from time to time. My wife always asks me, hey, what does Bitcoin need to reach in order for us to put a pool in? And I told her the other day, I was like, do you realize that there will be a point where we've accrued enough wealth in Bitcoin that we can put a pool in, but you realize I'm not selling my Bitcoin or spending my Bitcoin on a pool. Like, we will come up with fiat to cover the pool because the Bitcoin will continue to appreciate in value while our dollars won't. And I think that's like something a lot of people, we had a webinar yesterday with we partnered with another company for a webinar. And one of the, we opened it up for a lot of questions. We had over 100 questions come in. And one of them was, so the Bitcoin way, we only accept Bitcoin for payment and we have no fiat rails. And the question was, hey, is it true that you only accept Bitcoin? Someone told me that and I was kind of turned off and, you know, decided not to work with you guys. And fortunately, the company that we partnered with for this is very much on the same page as us. And he and our founder, who were both speaking on the panel, were like, you know, it's sort of the Jeff Booth model, right? Like, why would we be accepting an inferior currency if we're promoting Bitcoin as this important thing worth custodying, which is exactly what we help you do, worth doing the right way? Why would we be accepting an inferior form of money? I mean, when Bitcoin is an option, and, you know, we want to promote this notion of people saving in Bitcoin, using their Bitcoin when it's appropriate, and then go buy more Bitcoin with the dollars that you would have paid us if we had accepted dollars, which we don't.
Yeah. And, I think you never understand. It's funny, at Bitcoin First, there was one of the groups was about this, and I was the only one. And everyone else was like, so against me. And I'm like, guys, like the one girl was talking about how she used Fold because, you know, obviously then Strike, because she can like send Bitcoin, but it just deducts from her like bank account, from her US dollars. And I'm like, but don't you understand? You're just doing the same thing I'm doing. I'm just taking the US dollars after and buying the Bitcoin. I'm like, but sometimes I actually don't. Sometimes I actually know, like, oh, I'm going to spend 250 US dollars worth of Bitcoin. I just buy $250 and then I send it. So, you know, like to me, like, I don't understand what people don't understand about that. Like, it doesn't matter that you don't take US dollars, just whatever US dollars you're going to spend with you, just buy the Bitcoin and then send it to you guys.
Yeah. I guess for some people it's one more hoop to jump through, but it feels very worth it for the hope that we all believe Bitcoin provides. So
yeah, it's totally worth it to me. This is the way. So
that's right. So back to the conference. Tell me a little bit about how you see the conference evolving in the coming years. So, you know, general growth, more attendance, more speakers, other unique ways. Do you have sort of ideas as to, you know, if this is a success in January, what, you know, 2026 looks like?
Yeah, my intentions is to just grow this thing. And then, you know, one of the things that someone said, like, oh, that asked me, if this is a success, you know, what do you think you would do? And I think, you know, if we can get it really good and it becomes successful, I would like to kind of move it around Colombia for sure. And then potentially maybe even move it around in South America a little bit. I mean, I'd love to go over to Venezuela or go down to Ecuador or go down to Peru and do this in some of those places as well. You know, but for me, to me, it's important, like, hey, let's do one thing good first So, you know, I don't think we've gotten there yet. And to be fair, in any event that I've ever run, my goal the first year is like, let's get this off the ground and like do a good job with it. And then the next year, like generally, like in running youth sports events, generally the next year, what happens is other teams go, wow, that was a really good event that they had. I would love to be a part of that. And then they kind of come to me and we get them signed up. So my hope is like we do this year and we do a good job with it and people see it and people go, that would have been a lot of fun to go down to Medellin. I really wanted to go, but you know, I didn't know the person who was running it, or, you know, I wasn't sure it was really going to happen. You know, like I don't know, Pacific Bitcoin canceling kind of makes me feel like, you know, a little bit like people might start questioning whether these things are really going to happen or not. I hope that's not the case, but you know, like, you know, so people need to feel confidence in what they're doing, right? Like, I mean, that's like, so many things go hand in hand with Bitcoin, but like people have to feel confidence in what they're doing, and they're not going to make the move unless they feel confident, like that this is going to be, that it's going to happen and it's going to be good. And so, you know, we have to do what we have to do to get it off the ground the first year and make it good and, you know, make sure people, you know, get to see like what we were able to do down there. And then I think year two, it should grow from a spectator perspective. And then, you know, maybe three, we grow it a little more. And then year four, maybe we move it to, you know, Cartagena or Cali or Bogota. And then maybe, you know, maybe year five, we go over to, you know, I don't know, Venezuela or somewhere. So
very cool. So I know very little about event planning, but one thing I've observed is that it's no walk in the park. What has been the most challenging thing about running or putting together this event, particularly compared to some of the events you've done in the past with sports?
Yeah. So there's just some dynamics that, you know, we don't work with every day. One of them is, you know, just coordinating with the speakers, you know, like we, you know, got them to say, yeah, we're going to do it. And then we promoted them. But like, you know, just keeping in touch. I mean, it's a lot of like people to like constantly keep in touch with, making sure like, are you good? Are you still good? Are you still coming? So like that aspect has definitely been different and probably need to figure out how to do better at making sure our speakers are like, you know, all in and they're going to show up and they're going to do what they say they're going to do. And everyone has a good time. And, you know, we get them coordinated to talk about things they feel comfortable talking about. And also, you know, kind of match them up with other people that they might be good on a panel with. Like some of that is totally new and different for me. It's fun, but, you know, also different and challenging. And then I would say partially, I would say the hardest part is like getting the word out there. Like we've been really successful with that on the like event basketball side of the events. But you know, we did that over time. It took me, you know, 25 years to build up the, you know, I don't know. I think we have like 35,000 followers on our basketball Twitter and, maybe 20,000 on our Instagram. And, we probably have, I think we're very close to hitting 1,000 on the Bitcoin Medellin page, which is great in the short amount of time that we've had it up. But you know, we're still only reaching a really small fraction of people that, you know, we need to reach. So, it's also been a challenging marketing this thing and getting people to know that it's happening. And so, you know, one of the things that we've also been doing is my wife and I have been trying to go to like every Bitcoin event that's out there. So last weekend we were in LA. Now this weekend coming up, we're going to be in Atlanta at TAB and Halloween. And then the weekend after that, we travel to Medellin to try to talk to people directly there. And then the weekend after that, we'll be in San Salvador at Adopting Bitcoin. So, you know, just making the rounds at all these things has been challenging because the basketball stuff, you know, again, like I can sit in my office all day and talk to teams on the phone around the country. And, you know, at this point they know us and we know them and we don't have to go to them and meet them where they are. We can kind of get it done from home base. So that's been a challenge, is to just be a road warrior here and, you know, make sure my kids go to school when I'm out of town and you know, that type of stuff. So, but yeah, it's been fun too. So.
Well, good. Well, hey, let's start heading for home here. So real quick, give your best pitch that you can give to someone listening who is considering this, has just heard about this for the first time. How do you get someone, particularly from outside South America, where the flights are a little less convenient, maybe more expensive, pitch them on why Bitcoin Medellin conference.
Sure. I mean, I think you're going to be able to see a lot of great speakers, and not just see them, you're going to be able to rub elbows with them. I mean, how many of your listeners here have wanted to have a conversation with Jeff Booth? How many of them have wanted to have a conversation with Maya and talk to her about, you know, some of the stuff that she sees happening in Suriname and how she's going to be able to change their country for the better. And maybe she can get elected quick enough here, be the second country to accept Bitcoin. Well, really, maybe the third. I guess Central African Republic is on there too. But so, like, you know, how many people have wanted to speak to these people and never been able to be in a room with them, never been able to at least be in a intimate enough room with them to ask them questions, rub elbows with them, shake their hands. So I think it's going to be a really great time. You're going to have a lot of fun. Medellin is an absolutely beautiful city. It's called the City of Eternal Spring. The weather is beautiful there all the time. It's just absolutely amazing. And food is great. People are great. It's extremely affordable there. And we're going to take great care of you. If you come down, you know, not to say that people running these other conferences don't care about the people who attend, but like, this is a really small event. This is a first year event. We are going to appreciate you so much if you come to our conference. Whereas the other conferences, if you go, like, great. If you don't, who cares? Like, we really care. We're going to roll out the red carpet for every single person because, you know, we're just extremely, extremely grateful for you believing in our vision to do this thing. So.
That's a good pitch. I think you sold me. I need to check my calendar and see if I can make this work because sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. So final question for you. This is one I ask at the end of every episode of every guest. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and bonus points if it's unpopular amongst Bitcoiners?
That's a great question. You know, I mean, I think I have one, but I'm not even sure it's unpopular. I think it might actually be popular among Bitcoiners. So I'm not sure it's that unpopular. But, you know, I mean, one of the things is we're running this conference as like money maximalist here. And one of the things that really prompted us to run it was, we felt like Bitcoin is money. And all these like kind of extensive, like these alternative use cases to put like, you know, monkey JPEGs on Bitcoin and, you know, build runes and stamps and, you know, all these and shit coins on Bitcoin. Like, this is crap. Like, stop this, guys. Like, I appreciate the innovation, but I don't appreciate like, you know, the fees going to, you know, a million, and you know, the people in Venezuela who need this as money have a hard time using it. So, you know, like, to me, I don't know if that's an unpopular opinion. It might be popular. I would also say, like, I think, you know, and this was probably an unpopular opinion, but I think, you know, Bitcoiners have to kind of figure out, you know, how we're going to make this work in the future, because we've reached a point where, and again, this wouldn't be necessarily unpopular, but you know, we like, you know, you're not going to be able to buy coffee with Bitcoin, like on-chain Bitcoin. That just doesn't make sense. It's not going to make sense. Like, we have to figure out this scaling thing, and we have to figure out the scaling thing in a decentralized way, I think. Or otherwise, like, if we're figuring out scaling and all the scaling solutions are centralized, like, that's not a good look either. Like, we have to figure out the scaling in a decentralized way, or, you know, like, we only have something that can be used for like huge large scale transactions, and it will never be able to be used for anything else. So that might be unpopular, I don't know. But
yeah, no, I agree. I think it, probably a lot of people would agree with both of those premises generally. Obviously, the Ordinals crowd would disagree. I don't think that's mostly our audience, fortunately. You'll find another podcast to listen to if that's your thing. We're monetary maximalists.
Good. We're in agreement there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. So the one pushback I'd give you on the second point, while I agree optimally, everything you said is correct, I think the biggest win of Bitcoin is ending central banking, providing control of money to, or removing the control of money from bureaucrats to the people. And we had this talk on one of our podcasts with we do like an internal team podcast called Bitcoin Banter, and we were talking about Saylor's comments and my comment was I fundamentally and philosophically disagree with Saylor's comments, and I think we all did. but I'm not sure that in a free market, what he's describing isn't going to be demanded. And so I have a feeling there are going to be centralized solutions for banking, payment processing, a lot of different things that I will find to be inferior, but I think a lot of people aren't going to want to take the ownership and responsibility of their wealth that I do, or that you do, or that, you know, the Bitcoin way and many of our clients do.
Sure.
And so I completely agree philosophically with you. I'm hopeful that in a worst case scenario, Bitcoin ends central banking. And even if we have to accommodate some centralized institutions to facilitate this new world of finance, we can make it work. So again, I'm not promoting that, but just perhaps trying to be pragmatic about what could be. And again, I hope it doesn't, I hope that's not the way we go, but
sure. Would you not think that those entities could essentially be decentralized entities that, you know, facilitate the payments? And, you know, because one would hope that if we can have a decentralized base layer, we can also have a decentralized secondary layer to do those things. And I don't know if we have options for that right now, but
I think it's probably achievable. I think one of the challenges, you know, and this is kind of a general rule, is that the advantage of centralization tends to be efficiency. Right. Like, you know, the fact that Twitter is centralized means they can move quickly. They can have fast databases. Like part of like the reason we're able to have decentralized money in Bitcoin is because we tolerate, 10 minute settlement times versus instantaneous, where Visa, you know, you can, you know, it's not settled instantaneously, but you can buy your coffee with your credit card and walk away with it, you know, in a matter of seconds.
Right.
So I think it is possible. And I think there are so many smart people working on this stuff that I'm hopeful that a lot of what you're describing, it, you know, comes to pass. I'm just sort of mentally preparing myself for a world where I roll my eyes at a lot of things, a lot of solutions that come about and win in the free market, but I can still be grateful that the Fed's out of business and money printing is no longer wreaking havoc on our economy.
Right. I'm with you there.
Okay. Perfect. Well, hey man, I think that's a good place to wrap. Why don't you give a handoff? Tell people about where to find the conference, what it's called, where to find you online. Anything you want to share?
Yeah, sure. Well, our website is, I should just know this off the top of my head, but it's it's bitcoinmedellin.com. And our Twitter handle, I believe, is btcmedellinconf. Like CONF, so like the beginning of conference. So those would be the two places you can find us. We are on Nostr, but it's very small presence.
Don't have your info for
that. Yeah. So that's something we're going to work on, and is growing our Nostr presence. But the BTC Medellin CONF is where you find us on Twitter, and BitcoinMedellin.com is where you can find us on the internet.
Perfect. We'll put that in the show notes. John, hey, thank you so much for taking the time. Love what you guys are doing. Love seeing global adoption take hold, and looking forward to hopefully getting down there for this, and worst case, hearing about how it goes once you get through your first one.
Thank you. Appreciate you so much having us on and letting us get the word out there a little bit. It really means a lot.
Of course. Thank you, John. You take care.
All right. Take care.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Go check out Bitcoin Medellin Conference. Follow them on X. Follow them on Nostr. Go check out their website. I hope you can make it down there. I'm hoping to. I just need to check my schedule and see if that's something I could swing. Do me a huge favor. If you enjoyed this podcast, if you're enjoying the podcast generally, give us a like, subscribe to the channel, share it with someone. We would really appreciate your support. If you need help with proper 100% Bitcoin self-custody, if you need help with your online privacy, setting up a privacy phone, a Plan B residency option, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'd love to talk through that with you. Follow us on X at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me there, DM me, send me feedback, comments, thoughts on the show. It's @theothermjordan. And as always, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.